On today's College Football Inquirer, Amazon Prime is going to televise college basketball. How soon before Prime Video or Netflix or one of those is televising college football? Plus, is UCLA back? The Bruins are killing it on the recruiting trail under Bob Chesney. How quickly is he going to get UCLA turned around? Plus, in light of the Brendan Sorsby situation, how good is your team's backup quarterback situation? Spoiler alert, they're a lot better than they were last year this time. We'll talk about it all on today's College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer with Ross Dellinger and Stephen Godfrey. I am Andy Staples. And we got a little nugget of college basketball news last week that involves all the fun things. Billion-dollar companies, streamers, conferences fighting one another over stuff. It's interesting in and of itself. But it's even more interesting because of what it means for the future. Prime Video is going to be broadcasting college basketball next year. How soon before we see college football on Prime Video or Netflix or YouTube? Or is everybody going to keep their rights? Is everybody going to keep it where it is because it's a pretty valuable commodity for ESPN and ABC and CBS and NBC? But Ross Dellinger, you were the one who broke the story that the Big Ten was a little miffed about the idea of the ACC and ESPN sublicensing a Duke-Michigan game at Madison Square Garden to Amazon Prime. But let's talk about this deal first, what Duke's doing with Amazon Prime, with their basketball team, and then we'll talk about what it means for football because it is going to affect football at some point.
Yeah, well, it is. It's a fascinating situation, and perhaps given the brands and sort of the package of games maybe is kind of the first of its kind, right? So Duke has done a deal with Amazon with the sort of approval of the ACC and ESPN and to televise to Amazon will stream three games, Duke basketball games, Gonzaga. They play Gonzaga in Detroit. They play UConn in Las Vegas and then Michigan in Madison Square Garden. So that's kind of like the trio. We don't know any financial details, but I can bet that it's millions of dollars, plural, and especially it's millions of dollars potentially for the Duke basketball roster, as well as players market these games on Amazon and other outlets. And I think that that's a big piece of this as well. But the sort of precedent-setting situation here is that they are doing that the one of the ACC, perhaps the ACC's biggest basketball brand, is going outside of its television partner, ESPN, to do these one-off deals. And it sort of opened the door, as Andy mentioned, on potentially more of these happening. But there is an issue. It cropped up very, very quickly in that the Big Ten claims that it owns the Duke-Michigan game played in, it was supposed to be played in New York, because that is sort of a shared territory of the ACC and the Big Ten. And they rotate non-conference basketball games between their two leagues. And in the rotation, Big Ten is next. So they're saying
ESPN
they own
had Duke-Michigan in Washington. In that one where they played kind of in the middle of conference play.
Right.
It was actually the most watched regular season college basketball game on ESPN in 7 years, I believe. I think 4.3 million viewers, which would make it a kind of good it compares with a kind of good football game, which is big for basketball.
But despite this sort of dispute that's ongoing, which, you know, we could talk about later the resolutions there, but despite that, like, I think to me the most fascinating thing is that sort of ESPN and the ACC said okay to this because it does kind of crack the door, and other leagues are certainly watching closely. Many ADs are certainly watching closely, especially ADs of big football brands, as you mentioned, Andy, wondering, well, hold on, why can't we do non-conference games in our footprint and one-off games and earn millions and millions of dollars on top of our current TV deal?
There's that. There is, they've talked about this in football. Remember, when Notre Dame and USC were still trying to keep that series together, one of the things USC pitched was, let's put Notre Dame USC on Netflix, which USC's Big Ten partners very quickly were like, no. Fox is like, we paid lots of money when we brought you here because Notre Dame is going to be on your campus once every 2 years. And we were going to broadcast that. So these multi-billion dollar streamers have been circling, but they haven't really bitten yet until now. And I think it's interesting because we keep talking about the sports rights bubble. Because look, TV money funds all of this stuff. It is the single biggest funding agent for college sports. And it's, as we've talked about on the show, Godfrey, we've lamented this many, many times. TV has pretty much propelled realignment. It has done all this stuff.
It owns the sport, yeah.
The bubble that we keep talking about doesn't burst if a Netflix or a Prime Video jumps in. The bubble only bursts if the same cast of characters runs out of money.
There's a couple things I would like to help the audience contextualize this news with. One, historically, streamers have experimented first before jumping into large rights deals. So I'm talking specifically about what Apple has done in their rights agreements. Netflix, before they got involved heavily with the NFL, they actually took on sports scripted content. And as someone who makes what we call unscripted nonfiction sports content, like that's what my day job is, that's a ridiculously low entry fee compared to buying the rights to an actual like live sporting event. Yeah. So Apple was really kind of the case study here because they took MLS for a song. It was a very low overhead. They got to experiment. They also got to figure out like, how do we want to build out our live sports apparatus in terms of absorbing the production cost? Then they got involved with F1 for an agreement that they've renewed. Now that has become very profitable for F1 as it has grown, thanks to Netflix, who got involved with Drive to Survive. So what I find interesting about Prime here is a couple things. This is a small lift. You don't have to absorb a lot of overhead. You're sub-licensing these games. And just for context here, the dollar amount, which we're not aware of, look, college basketball at its best is still a fraction of the college football audience. Well, Andy, while you were talking, I know you already mentioned the numbers. Everyone got really excited about this Duke-Michigan regular season game this past basketball season, as they should, because it popped a big number. And the college basketball regular season has kind of been a television wasteland. Really, all the emphasis, all the money and all the attention goes to the postseason tournament, which is something college football fans kind of freak out about. So the total audience was about 4.3 million viewers on ESPN for Duke Michigan back in February. I just pulled two games at random. Yeah. 2024 Ohio State Oregon on NBC peaked at 13.4 million. And then a game that I was at, I just randomly thought of it last season, standard SEC game in primetime, Georgia and Texas in Athens. That game, by the way, didn't have the stakes that the other one did. 7.55 million viewers, and it averaged at its peak 10.43 million. So again, we're talking about a much bigger sport. So what we're doing here in this segment is kind of like providing the supposition of would they go to college football? This is what you should watch out for. ESPN is doing this for a reason. And I think the reason might be down the road that one of the ways that ESPN and or Disney, if Disney does not spin off and sell ESPN, creates a new profit stream as cable dies out is by sub-licensing content and becoming basically its own clearinghouse or its own
It becomes the middleman.
Yes.
Basically, the cable company used to be.
Imagine other content providers, services, streamers, whatever you want to call it. Rather than dealing direct with the actual source, ESPN essentially becomes a kind of way station or a middleman, as Andy has said, because if that now here for that to happen, that has to work. That has to work several times over on these sub-licensing agreements. So I'll spin this forward.
ESPN is doing this with college football playoff games too.
I'll spin this forward. They have sub-licensed every college football playoff game that conflicts with the NFL regular season. It's gone to basically the amalgamation that is currently Warner Turner, which is going to eventually become Paramount. Don't ask. Don't worry about it right now. It honestly is too complicated. As we potentially expand that inventory, that could be another place where Prime, who, by the way, now has an operational agreement with the NFL, They know how to put on a live football game. They've done it a few times now, more than a few. They have Thursday nights. They have some special event inventory. Could easily step in and say, hey, Andy, do you remember that first round we dreamed up, the play-in weekend that we suggested instead of conference championships?
We will buy that from you, yes.
So now all of a sudden, boys, we don't have to worry about the television landscape of that weekend, potentially, if we have an expanded college football playoff, if Prime/Amazon feels like it makes financial sense. They're not buying the cow. They're just paying a pretty decent market rate for the milk.
So I will take that very logical and I don't think conspiratorial theory at all. Mm-mm. I think that is just
That's just market analysis. Yeah.
Yeah. That is just following the record. Let me throw you something a little more conspiratorial, but no less feasible.
Okay.
We have not yet talked. Well, we've briefly mentioned the behemoth that controls all of this stuff. There's one organization that controls all of this stuff, which is crazy because Netflix is just it makes gobs of money. Amazon is one of the largest companies in the world, but one organization controls pretty much what everybody does, and that is the NFL. And the NFL is about to redo its rights deals with CBS. Because they just had an ownership change and it triggered an early clause. Mm-hmm. It's got look-ins with Fox. It's got look-ins with ESPN that are coming up. They are going to strap those entities over a barrel and extract as much cash as humanly possible using Netflix, Prime Video, mm-hmm. and Google/YouTube mm-hmm. as the leverage points. Because they also would like more content. Guys, well, Godfrey, do you have your copy of the club handy?
Huh. Mr. Staples, I happen to have it sitting on my desk. Isn't that strange?
Look at that.
Let's go to hard camera. How
the English Premier League became the wildest. There are a lot of words there. But
how the English Premier League became the wildest, richest, most disruptive force in sports.
Yes. If you've not read The Club yet, if you're a fan of college football, you need to read The Club because it tells you everything that's going to happen. It's like the sports almanac from Back to the Future 2. So the club starts with a meeting of all of the big English soccer franchises. And they're deciding if they're going to get together and form what became the Premier League. And the person they're talking to is Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch has just created an entity called B Sky B, which is going to become Sky Sports. And Rupert Murdoch is going to offer an obscene amount of money to televise these guys if they form a league. So that works. That happens. He does it. Shortly after that, Rupert Murdoch, who owns News Corporation, Fox Broadcasting, goes, that works so well. I'm going to buy rights to the most popular sporting consortium in America, and that's the NFL. Now, remember, Fox has tried to become the fourth broadcast network at this point. Did you guys ever watch the Secret Life of Beans Baxter? Love that show.
Can't say I did.
I did not.
Did not hit. Tracy Ullman's show hit. The Simpsons spun off of that. Married with Children was a big hit. As powerful as those things were, they would not have been able to carry a fourth broadcast network into true prominence. They needed something else. What did Fox need? It needed the NFL. How did Fox get the NFL? It put a Godfather offer on the table, and CBS, which had been broadcasting the ABC at the time, or the NFC at the time, goes, oh God, that is way too rich for our blood. We can't do that. Now, all of a sudden, Fox has the Dallas Cowboys and the San Francisco 49ers, and it is now a legit player. It is a real thing. CBS is... So, everybody remembers when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's going to fight to keep the NFL now. You got to pay through the nose to keep the NFL. That's Fox. That's CBS. That's all of them. I know ESPN considers the SEC as a tentpole for its future survival. So, like, they're not in any danger of doing anything different. Like, what if Fox has to pay so much money that all it's paying for the Big Ten suddenly isn't enough? Could they sell to Netflix? Could they sell to Prime Video?
I'm less worried about that. Well, I'm not worried about any of this. I don't know. I think feel like that's less likely than a simultaneous dissolution of the players that we acknowledge on the board. And so we actually move into a Super League format wherein maybe ESPN swoops in and decides this is the time we're going to cherry pick that the top end of the SEC, the top end of this league, the top end of this league, and then reconstruct the entire thing. And maybe ESPN just decides we're going to be the home of college football.
Which, or they've or been smarter about this than most
it's
places.
Top division, I should say. Yeah. It's top division. Yeah.
Yep. It's fascinating because there's so many different things that could happen. And like I'll point out, remember when I was talking about when Fox bought the NFL and CBS didn't have it? What did that inspire CBS to do? Make a larger investment in college football. They signed the SEC deal that eventually became essentially the best deal in broadcast sports.
Mm. Well, I don't think Fox or even ESPN, and certainly many of the other media outlets, are super thrilled at the situation playing out with Duke because, and I think conference offices are also concerned. Right, because I don't think anybody wants to see a network, anybody at the conference office or at these big media legacy outlets want to see the continuation of this trend in any way of one-offs because that's what they're paying for.
Yeah,
right? They're paying for the big brand matchups.
Be less concerned because if you're a smart person in a conference office, you want the largest company in the world to throw money at you because you eventually want to try to sell them your entire package and portfolio. So
at least have them bidding.
Yes. And that's what our friend Matt Brown, who runs the Extra Points newsletter, I laughed. He was, you know, talking about your story, Ross, and about this whole situation. And he said the complaint from the Big Ten sounds like the argument of someone who wishes they'd thought of it first.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of folks around the country that are watching to see how this plays out. ADs who want to do this, right? Especially with football, and coaches who want to do this, and then conference offices who don't want their biggest brands doing this. So it's going to be fascinating to see sort of what happens with the, first of all, the Duke Michigan situation. But secondly, even if that gets resolved, and there are some ways that it can get resolved, who's the next program to do this? Because I know that a lot, you know, you mentioned USC and Notre Dame, Andy. There were some other matchups with Notre Dame, I think, maybe even going overseas internationally. And there was some pushback on that. It does. So you can do it. It takes you out of the footprint.
International water.
So, but
can we play on a aircraft carrier? They did a few basketball games like that.
If I'm one of these conference commissioners that's blowing you up, Ross, talking about how unhappy I am about this, here's my question to them. Do you feel in control? Do you feel like you're piloting this right now? To quote from a philosopher named Bane from a Batman movie. do you feel like you're in control? Do you feel in control? If you're registering your, I put it this way, any conference official right now who's registering their discontent to the media or trying to back channel about how this is bad for the sport, that to me signals that someone's losing control.
Yeah.
And
that, little cozy arrangement, by the way, this used to be a much book. More quaint deal with the Bulls. Remember when they're like, but our deals with the Bulls are great. And everybody's like, you know, you're leaving a bunch of money on the table. Yeah. And why? Mm.
Mm-hmm. That book, Andy, that you mentioned, The Club, is a fascinating look at the construction of the Premier League. But the construction of the Premier League is built on the skulls and the defeated bodies of a bunch of small-time provincial commissioners, leadership groups that
Godfrey,
thought
it's pro wrestling.
Soccer.
It's the regional outfits.
Yeah. Oh, it always has been. Yeah. Yeah. What Andy's referencing is that before there was something called the WWF, which is now the WWE, everything in professional wrestling was a territory, much like college football conferences. And then one very, very ruthless individual, Vince McMahon Sr., had the wherewithal and the vision to start consolidating. And then his son, who was even more ruthless, named Vince McMahon Jr., who's the one that you guys know, decided we're going to nationalize this thing, buy up all the territories, burn off any competition that doesn't want to join us, and then we're going to nationalize with something called cable TV. Sound familiar?
None of this is new. Now, what is new is the Prime Video part of it, Netflix potentially jumping in, because we've seen Netflix dabble a little bit with college football with documentary type stuff. It's interesting with Netflix because they have not dove headlong into live sports yet. They have had some live events. They've had the Christmas Day football game, or the NFL game. But for the longest time, they said, we don't want live events. We want things that can live in our library forever, because that's where the value is. They have since pivoted on that philosophy, and they now seem to be headed toward more live stuff.
One problem with Netflix that I would keep an eye on as far as becoming a player in this space, Netflix overestimated their Christmas audience. And right. So one of the live events that they just had was opening day for MLB, and I believe it was the Giants and Yankees. Mm-hmm. And they had to actually burn off ad inventory as a make good. If you work in that business, you understand what a make good is. But it says that they sold advertising inventory saying that X amount of people would watch those Christmas Day games. They underperformed nominally, not to a massive degree. Yeah. So they had to basically give out free advertising as a make good on this Giants-Yankees game. So Netflix has not yet got its sea legs, and the margins on live events are dictated by entities who know how to sell advertising and have longstanding agreements. And that's why Ted Sarando specifically, when he talks about live sports, that's the hesitation. Because the entire idea of dropping billions with a B for live sports is that you're going to make billions with a B on advertising. And that's not Netflix's model.
Right. It's funny because it's almost like going to the movie theater. They break even on the movie ticket that you buy. They make money if you buy the $9 popcorn. And the advertising is that, because sports rights are so valuable and so low margin, because everybody knows they're so valuable, that you have to be able to sell advertising on top of them, even if you're a subscription service.
Yeah.
That's why if you're of a certain age, your favorite ESPN show doesn't exist anymore, because that was not making them any money whatsoever. But the talent demands got higher and higher. The audience didn't accompany it, and there's no revenue model for that. The only thing that really works right now on actual cable TV for sports is what we call shoulder programming, which is like the studio show before and at halftime and then right after a game, because it's cheap to produce and it actually expands the ad inventory marginally, where you can put more live event advertising around it. That's why you have a 2.5-hour pregame show where like Frank Caliendo and you know, a band shows up and Terry Bradshaw, like all that.
Yeah. And that particular pregame show is television. That's the Fox one. That is considered incredibly valuable. And again, Fox and the NFL, same thing. So that's why this is so interesting, is if Prime Video does decide, because Amazon's business model completely different from these other things. Amazon's business model is, we want people to sign up for Prime because our numbers tell us when they sign up for Prime, they spend, the last time I saw it was several years ago, it was like $1,500 more per year on average than someone who isn't signed up for Prime. That's a lot of money when it's over millions and millions of people. So that's their goal. Plus, they can instantly beam things for you to buy with one click of your phone during the game. That's something the other places can't do. So they have a different incentive, different model. We'll see if it's something like this. As Godfrey pointed out, this basketball thing is a test balloon. Mm-hmm. And we'll see how people, because I got to be honest, two of those games are during football season. Not many people are going to watch.
Yeah.
The Duke-UConn game and the Duke-Michigan game are during football season. The Duke-Gonzaga game is outside of football season. Better chance of people watching that one.
I can't remember if on the 21st, if that's a playoff, December 21st, the Duke-Michigan day, if that's a, I'm guessing that's not a playoff game.
If it's a Saturday, that's the playoff day, but I have to get my calendar.
Because that would change. So the 21st is a Monday.
Okay.
So you would think that would do decently well.
Yeah. There's Monday night football but of course, again,
if that game happens, right? Because I think there are three, and that's what I wanted to get to, is folks probably reading my Friday story about the Big Ten and Fox pushing back and saying that they control this game, not Amazon or not ESPN. How does this resolve itself? And I think there's three paths here. One, Michigan just doesn't play in the game because the Big Ten and Fox say you can't play in the game. Two, they move the game outside of what's called the shared territory that the ACC and Big Ten have, so they can move the game to like
Windsor, Dallas. Ontario, make it a home game, you know, for Michigan.
They don't have to go that far. But, or the third thing would be Michigan, you know, compromising with Fox in the Big Ten in some way by giving by giving in to something or agreeing to participate
in
something
else. What if Amazon,
you
know, pays some money to Fox to sublicense some content?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. Yeah, maybe that happens. I would guess that Fox would not necessarily agree to that because in the Big Ten as well, because they don't want to set a precedent. So they don't want this to happen at all.
If I'm the Big Ten, I would like to set the precedent of Prime Video giving me money. So
yeah,
Fox may not want to set that precedent, but
inventory, Andy. They want their inventory.
I don't think that, Ross, I don't think they have a choice. These people who are telling you, like this is going to happen without them. I just assume this whole project was like a Trojan horse to get the worst, like the penultimate Duke and Michigan fans in one place, so we could potentially quarantine or sequester them forever. Like lock the door. I think maybe a false flag operation.
I think people liked the way that game worked out last year, and it was a kind of a fun deal. Now, again, this one is happening while football season is still going on. The NFL season is still going on. The college football season will still be going on. So I'm not optimistic about the numbers on that one, but I see what they're trying to do here, and I think it's interesting. And it's funny because I remember there was the show Ballers with The Rock. There was a subplot in one of the seasons, and it's basically everybody stopped watching at this point. Where USC was trying to sell its broadcast rights independent of the Pac-12, as if that was a thing you could do. And I was like, you can't do that. This is a stupid show. Apparently you can do that. So
yeah.
Didn't that show predict Las Vegas NFL though?
It did. I think Las Vegas NFL was pretty far down the road when that show talked about
just giving,
it, but
just giving the Rock his flowers.
That's Rob Corddry was a trailblazer. All right. When we come back, speaking of Big Ten teams in Los Angeles, let's talk about the other Big Ten team in Los Angeles. UCLA is on a recruiting heater. You heard that right. What's Bob Chesney doing to get the Bruins going? We'll talk about it when we come back. We are back at the College Football Inquirer, and headlines I did not think I would be reading if you'd asked me 8 months ago. UCLA tearing up the high school recruiting scene from Bruin Report Online. In the last 5 days, the UCLA football program under Bob Chesney secured commitments from five four-stars and two highly regarded three-stars, all told UCLA's high school recruiting class in 2027 stands at 16 commitments with 9 of them 4 stars. Now, Bob Chesney is getting it done. They're in the top 10 of the rivals rankings right now. Again, it is May, so this could change. But last year we saw USC doing this where they stepped up in their high school recruiting. And I would argue they stepped up even further than UCLA has here, and they held the class together.
Yeah.
So, but UCLA has not even hosted an official visit yet.
Yeah, and that's pretty remarkable. And number 4 in the country, their 2027 commits, number 4, number 2 in the Big Ten, only behind USC. I think USC is probably a big reason of why this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And you see you see your rival school across the way doing so well, I think that automatically drives competition and probably the commitment to resources at UCLA that we maybe haven't seen in the last couple years when it comes to, or several years, when it comes to football recruiting. Look, there's a way, we talked about in the show a lot, there's a way around, an easy way around this cap, right? And USC has sort of figured it out in the high school level and started doing it better than anybody.
They did it first, right, Ross?
They did. And that's why there is so much pressure. We talk about Lincoln Riley and the pressure on USC is because last year around this time, right, where you had the front loading, there was some, you know, I think they were out ahead of everybody when it came to not just front loading for the current roster, but front loading for the future roster. And not to say UCLA is doing the same exact thing, but I would imagine that when your rival's doing well and in committing so many resources, that you feel like you have to as well.
I want to believe about UCLA, but I don't. And I want to be clear about who I'm being critical of here. It's not Bob Chesney. I think Bob Chesney is in that weird class of 2026, I guess. I call them the fraternity of actual human beings. So it's all these coaches that have intact souls that I talked about recently, who I think are like fundamentally good human beings.
I think there was just a generational shift, and the fact that they're human beings is a quaint coincidence.
That's weird. It's like, it's almost like someone retired a few years ago and changed the tenor of the kind of human being you're supposed to be. I don't know who that would be, though. So Bob Chesney, I think when it was obvious he was next man up, right? He was going to be positioned for one of these gigs.
Has you know, won at every level. So like,
yeah,
he's a young version of what we saw from Kurt Cignetti, because Bob Chesney has won at Division III, Division II, FCS, and Group of Six.
And a lot of energy, like Kurt Bob Chesney. A lot of energy.
Yeah. So the guy has a very distinct Northeastern background. I kind of thought, it felt like he was 5 years early for the Penn State consideration. I think he could have killed that job if Penn State had deigned to sort of look at someone who they felt like had relative inexperience. So when he got this gig, I felt bad for him. And here's why. UCLA is one of the greatest on-paper jobs in football, period. It's right up there with North Carolina. It's almost like those two schools have something in common.
The color
this blue. This is a sweater vest set. This is a group of individuals with a lot of money, but very little follow through when it comes to football. This is a on paper gold mine, but so is Chapel Hill. You saw what they did. I think Chesney's a fantastic hire. I've been watching the social media clips they've been putting out. There's more energy. There's more awareness of UCLA football than there has been since I can remember. But Andy, we can pick apart why the Chip Kelly era failed, and we can talk about other...
This is the opposite of that, though. The Chip Kelly era failed because they were not trying to recruit like this. Kelly was not about that life. That's why he picked UCLA. Yeah. And he had the UCLA job and the Florida job in hand.
That's totally accurate. But there's a common denominator, which is UCLA. So I think at a certain point, Bob Chesney is going to run into what I fear is the inevitable, which is that UCLA is not going to financially back up what they're talking about. And if you're watching this and listening to this, and like, I know a lot of agents, I know a lot of LA people, they're all USC people, but if you want to prove me wrong, if you want to point to something, if you want to show me what's different in Westwood, other than the fact that you're flashing around the Wasserman name as if that means something, I've worked for Wassermans before. It's a lot of talk. I would love for Bob Chesney to make a dent in the Big Ten. But if you look at the mountain they have to climb in football in this league, I am going to be skeptical until proven otherwise. Not of Bob Chesney, not of this staff. I thought he's brought together a really good staff. Andy, we talked about this with John Summerall when we talked about Florida like a week ago. It's always really telling to me to see young hot coach leaves the group, goes to the power job. Who does he bring with him? Who does he tap? How big is his network to bring in that first time power staff? I like what he's done. I like the energy that's coming out of the staff. I just hope that UCLA follows through with it.
I think it's possible. And I'll tell you why. There have been moments where this is like Jim Mora was able to get some top end talent at UCLA. Now that was the previous recruiting era, but he could get five star guys to come to UCLA. It just wasn't in the same abundance as, say, an Ohio State or a Georgia or an Alabama. But he could get them there, and they had some success under him, and then it kind of fell apart. You mentioned North Carolina as a place that can never get there, but I would argue that if Marvin Austin doesn't tweet from the Live nightclub in South Beach in 2010...
Who among us?
That North Carolina team that Butch Davis had assembled would have competed for the national title.
Yeah, no, but I watched them play LSU that year. They were really good.
Right, and they didn't even have most of their good players. So... Yeah. What I'm saying is, it is possible. The circumstances are narrow, but it is doable. And this is a new era. So if they've said, we are going to financially back you, Bob Chesney, we trust your evaluations, we trust your judgment, that you're going to go after the right players that work for you, that do, you know, that, you know, maybe they aren't the most expensive because those are the five-star guys.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they're investing, like they're beating out some very big name schools for these players.
I said, I want to believe. This is not a slight against the Bruins. I would love to see.
No, it is a slight against the Bruins. It's not a slight against Chesney.
Oh, no, it's a slight against the UCLA boosters who are quick to get on Instagram, but very history tells us pretty poor at their follow through. So like,
I do feel like it has the seeds. It like if you actually do follow through.
Yeah, it no doubt. Work. Yes, it's on paper. Yes, there is a blueprint. Yes, I am not sitting here trying to talk to you about like how is Wyoming going to raise enough NIL or rev share in one of the least populated states that doesn't have football players. This is Los Angeles, California. You can pay athletes, get off your ass and be about it. I love the Chesney hire. I'm highly skeptical. Which of the,
it feels
the company
like they're getting off
him.
Their asses is what I'm saying, because
feels like. Yes.
Yeah. Feels like. I, you know, the I wonder, too, if they're taking advantage of we've discussed this before about how certain schools, plenty of schools are just not signing as many high school players, right? Because they're leaving so many players for the portal. And I just wonder how many commitments that UCLA has gotten of players who, you know, would have normally gone somewhere else, but those spots aren't necessarily there because of the portal. I don't know for a fact that, but I'm curious of the UCLA's of the world, those mid-tier, sort of mid to lower tier power conference
programs. Well,
we know
Texas Tech is doing it. Texas Tech's throwing big money around. They are number two in the Rivals ranking for the class of 27 right now. They have the number one overall prospect. Like they made a conscious decision. It's the same, like the same conscious decision they made when Cody Campbell tweeted that person, I'm going to go buy us a better offensive line. And then they had that transfer portal class last year that resulted in the Big 12 title. They also at the same time made a commitment to doing it at the high school level. It just takes longer. And you're going to see that come to fruition come signing day in December for Texas Tech. And it sounds like, and you saw it for USC this past signing day where, you know, when they hired Chad Bowden, their GM away from Notre Dame, and USC said, we are going to recruit the best high school class in the country. And they went out and did. Thanks to, as Ross pointed out, a significant investment. And it held. It held. So the fact that money is bolstering this gives you a chance to hold. And look, this year, Chesney takes over. He's got his quarterback in Nico Iamaliava. They bring in a portal class that, you know, we'll see, but I trust his evaluation skills because this is a guy that, look, if you won at Holy Cross and then you won at JMU, you are a really good evaluator of talent.
Yes. Like, we know that. And they're betting on that, like, because I talked about the staff earlier. The core of it is from JMU, which I'm not saying, I said earlier, it's always interesting to look. There's no right or wrong way to do it. You can import the group of staff with you and have success. You can cherry pick guys. I've seen success in both ways. Derek Gray's the GM, came from Florida State. There's a lot of sort of like attachments to this, meaning like Florida State, not in the greatest financial shape in the world, but what he did at FSU with some of those classes was really impressive.
Yeah.
So,
Florida State's a prime example. I just had a story published at On3 where I charted the number of transfer players who've been drafted over the last four drafts, basically since the rules changed. Florida State was killing it. Florida State had 10 transfers drafted in 23 and 24, and they've had one drafted since. And that's because everybody else jumped into the market and offered more competitive wages. Like, that's because Texas Tech jumped in. That's because Indiana got better at it. That's because Oregon took it very seriously all along. But I think you're right, Godfrey. You put someone who has an eye into a situation where there's some money to spend, you're going to do all right.
Go ahead. I was going to say, Ray had a bunch of experience from Oregon State. If there was a criticism, it's that this staff is a little light on West Coast. but that's why to me it's interesting in the news, Andy. They're doing so well with high schools right now. I think they're trying to kind of overcompensate for their inexperience on the West Coast. So far, it's working. Again, want it to work, guys. Want to believe. That was the name of my segment. I want to believe.
I want to believe. You know, we talked a lot about UCLA and resources and all that. I don't want to look over the fact that Bob Chesney is an incredibly personable, and I can't imagine him being anything other than a really, really good recruiter. If you spend any time, sitting with him, like, I mean, he comes across as one of those guys that's kind of fun to be around, who you want to play for and who your parents would want you to play for. He just comes across as that. And he's got a long history, right? His dad was a coach, I believe. And then obviously he's been at the lowest of the levels. So he can probably empathize with a lot of football players in their families. And so I don't want to overlook that, because they probably have had to commit the resources maybe that they haven't in the past, especially watching what USC is doing. But arguably they made the best hire of the cycle this year, and they locked him down really early. You know, they really hired him. I don't know how public this is. I know you guys know about this, but like, I think it was 3 weeks. I think for 3 weeks they had him sort of signed, so to speak, before announcing it. And
part of that was JMU's playoff run. And like
they delayed it at least a week. Yeah. At any announcement. But it was a great hire. And I think there are probably other places on the East Coast, Godfrey, you mentioned one in State College, that just didn't want to give him a shot because of the experience at this level. But we have seen people at this level, or at the lower levels, thrive at this level. And I think he's another example of it.
Want to play a schedule game real fast. If you're looking for a way to evaluate early, I think there is a kind of hidden importance to the early part of UCLA season, because they open at Cal. We've talked a lot in this offseason about what Tosh is doing at Cal and the importance of reinvigorating that program. So for a game for 2 year one coaches that are definitely in a designated rebuild, there's a little bit of like mindshare equity in the California recruiting circles for that game. They also come home and play what I think will be a very good San Diego State team with Sean Lewis the next week. And this is before they get into, of course, just the regular slog of conference play. So worth checking them out early. I'm kind of curious what they can do hitting the ground, because this was, it was just a weird ass season last year for UCLA. There's no other way to describe it, right? Like we're upsetting thought to be national title contenders, and we're having the new Heisel moment. We're also one of the worst football teams in the country to start the year. So like, I don't even know how to contextualize last season other than we are definitely rebuilding for 26.
Yeah, it is a winnable like first four games at Cal, San Diego State, Purdue, and at Maryland. I mean, it would be pretty something if
Text Sean Lewis that real fast.
Ross. Yeah.
Cal one's very interesting because folks who follow this show know, there's a concept called calimony, which is what UCLA has to pay Cal because UCLA left for the Big Ten and helped destroy
the
Pac-12.
That's going to be fun, man. It's certainly not Lane Ole Miss level acrimony, but like there's a little spice there. There's a little something going on there. How much would Tosh and the Cal boosters and the people who really care about Cal football, after being left behind? Dad went to the store for a pack of I can't say cigarettes. It's California.
For a little bit of weed.
Yeah, for a little bit of weed. And how satisfying would it be for Cal to win that game?
But UCLA, you've got a couple swing games there, and if you're UCLA and you can beat, I'm looking at the Big Ten schedule, Maryland, Wisconsin, Michigan State, Minnesota, and then let's say you can beat Illinois. Like you're in good shape going forward. If Chesney does what he's supposed to do, there's a good chance he can win those games.
I'm just going to text Bielema real fast. And Andy said,
stop it. That's the one that's the really hard one. We'll see. We'll see where Fickle is. I didn't say anything about Oregon or Michigan or USC, but look.
Well, the thing is too, like, are we going to continue to see the West Coast schools when they go East, like how much of a struggle are we? I mean, we obviously, it's been noted, especially the LA schools, how difficult it is when they go East and how few of games. Wasn't USC's win last year at, was it at Illinois or at?
The USC lost to Illinois. Yeah.
No. Okay. So it must have been.
It was week four. It was a big CBS game, and USC lost that game. That was like the Illinois.
And remember, USC lost at Maryland in its first year in the Big Ten. Yeah. So UCLA at Maryland on September 26th. We'll see where they put that kickoff.
That might not be a travel problem. That might be a Lincoln Riley problem.
Maybe a Lincoln Riley.
Well, and Bob Chesney's just going home, guys. Let's be real here.
Yeah.
That's he's Mr. East Coast.
Yeah. Yeah,
Mr. Eastern Time Zone.
You know those. You know those weak Angelinos can't handle the brisk autumn weather of Northwest Indiana and Maryland.
The world moves on. All right,
God, shut up.
Good luck to the UCLA Bruins. I'm excited about this because I do think it's a program that if run properly, can be very good. And so it's exciting when there's new blood. And I think this is a great example of that. When we come back, though, we talk about other potential new blood, and it's not always happy when these guys come into a game. But how good is your backup quarterback? I think a lot of schools around the country were asking that question as the Brendan Sorsby story was unfolding last week. And it's an interesting question to ask because this era has changed how you stock a quarterback room. This year, though, I will say, I think the backup situations are better than they were this time last year. There's a couple reasons for that. We'll talk about it when we come back. We are back to College Football Inquirer and the Brendan Sorsby news. Not a lot new to tell you over the last couple of days, but it's something that has really kind of shaken up everybody around college football, because obviously you have the suspend or the investigation, him going to seek treatment away from the Texas Tech team because of gambling. That all is something everybody's cognizant of and everybody's worried about. The other thing everybody's worried about is coaches are looking at their teams now and going, if something happened to my starting quarterback, and it could be something more conventional, like an injury during the season, how confident am I about my backup quarterback entering the game? And I remember, guys, we asked this question on my On3 show last July or August, and we were like, oh God, there are no backup quarterbacks that people will be confident in. I think this year's a different story. I think the lack of a spring transfer portal forced coaches to be more cognizant of, do I have a backup that I am confident in? Because take you back a year ago, Trinidad Shambliss had not even arrived on Ole Miss's campus yet. Joe Judge and Charlie Weiss Jr. had just gotten through looking at a bunch of film of spring transfer portal quarterbacks and were trying to decide if they wanted to recruit the guy out of Fair State.
In fact, Andy, a kind of a little known sort of fact is Trinidad wasn't eligible. When he got to Ole Miss's campus, they denied him eligibility to enroll in classes, and he had to scramble to, you know how this stuff works out in the SEC, sort of, if you're an SEC quarterback.
What are you implying?
And stuff kind of worked out, but it's crazy to look back like a year ago and think we didn't know hardly who this kid was, right?
I remember doing this little exercise, and there were not many names we could come up with. Alabama felt fine because they had Ty Simpson starting and Austin Mack had been in the program, and then Keelan Russell was a freshman. But like Aaron Filo was the name that kept coming up because he was Haynes King's backup at Georgia Tech, and he played a little bit in 24 when King was dinged up and played well. And he's like, okay, well, you could put him in and you'd probably feel pretty good. That was about it. This year's a little bit different, but I want to go through. I had a story about this last week, and we can go through some of the programs that probably feel a little better about this than they did this time last year. And you know, if something were to happen, and Alabama, I mentioned last year, probably would have been okay. Alabama's definitely okay now. Like, it's either Austin Mack or Keelan Russell. They haven't decided who's going to start yet, But whoever doesn't start, I think they're going to feel very comfortable putting that person in a game. You know, Notre Dame has CJ Carr, but they've got three like Notre Dame's the oldest of the old school. They have three scholarship quarterbacks on their bench that they recruited out of high school. Nobody does that anymore.
Oh, very old school. That's probably the a little bit of the advantage of being at a place like Notre Dame where the players do go there for something other than football.
Yeah. And like to get the degree. And yeah. Now, two of them are true freshmen, but still, I think it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. Michigan was an interesting one this year because you guys remember last year, Michigan got Mikey Keene, who'd played at UCF and Fresno State. And the idea was Mikey Keene was either going to compete with Bryce Underwood or maybe even start over Bryce Underwood so you could then ease Bryce Underwood into the role. Mikey Keene gets hurt before spring practice, never ends up playing a snap for Michigan because Bryce Underwood, you know, takes all the snaps in the spring. They're like, okay, you're our guy. We don't know when Mikey's going to be ready. And it would have been an abject disaster for Michigan last year if Bryce Underwood had gotten hurt. This year, not only do they have Braden Fowler-Nicolosi coming from Colorado State, who was a multi-year starter at Colorado State. He's going to enroll this month. But they also got to look at Tommy Carr, who's a freshman, CJ's younger brother, grandson of former Michigan coach Lloyd Carr. And they're like, wow, this guy's pretty damn good. So now they're feeling pretty good about it.
Shout out to Michigan for basically turning the Mountain West into a development league. Because Mikey Keene was like supposed to be the next Jake Haener. Now you have Braden Fowler-Nicolosi, who I watched
Carr because he didn't get there in time.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. I mean, they are actually development leagues now, so that wasn't really a joke. This is interesting, Andy, and I'm glad you wrote this piece. But I'm just curious, like, I know we don't get access to these numbers. Everybody looked at what happened at Ole Miss and said, man, we got to be on it. And the staff at Ole Miss, and I don't know who you give total credit for, if it's Joe Judge, if it's Billy Glasscock, if it's Lane Kiffin or all of them, they went after a starter for a backup role. And that was considered to be like a really sort of like
he was gonna
bold
go to
move.
Temple. Shambliss was going to go to Temple. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but here's what I'm getting at. What happens when you have the situation that isn't Ole Miss? What happens when you pay money for a starter in Trinidad Shambliss and he just sits for most of the year, if not the entire year? I'm just curious, like, what the financial balance looks like of carrying more than one truly quality quarterback.
Well, I don't think they paid Trinidad Shambliss
starter
anywhere
money
near what they're paying.
No.
Yeah. But
no,
you're right. They probably
did
pay,
either.
They probably did have to pay a little premium because he was going to start at Temple. So they had you got to pay him more than Temple was going to pay him because Temple had the added bonus of you're the day one starter.
Yeah.
I think it was more like halfway to seven figures.
Yeah.
Okay.
Trinidad.
But you've got to invest in that. And so the Texas Tech situation is really interesting because Joey McGuire actually threw this out unprompted last year after Will Hammond came into the game for Baron Morton. Baron Morton gets hurt in the Utah game. Will Hammond comes in, leads them to a win against Utah. Joey McGuire throws out, oh, by the way, Will Hammond, our backup quarterback, is on a multi-year deal.
Yeah, 2-year contract. Make sure to let everybody know he's got a second year to his contract, which he might need, obviously, with this.
Will Hammond may wind up being their starter this year once he gets back from a torn ACL. If he hadn't torn his ACL, this might have gone differently. It depends on who you ask at Texas Tech. Some people say that if Will Hammond never gets hurt, they don't go get Brendan Sorsby out of the portal. I don't know if that's true. I'm guessing after 23-0 in the Orange Bowl, there was significant pressure to go get a QB.
I'm just sitting here trying to game out the best life possible. And the best life possible is to be like a 24-year-old, not super athletic, kind of tall, awkward white guy. I speak from experience, who signs a multi-year backup deal. That sounds like a good ass life, y'all. Like,
it's
no pressure on
quarterback
you.
Quarterback is the most popular person on campus. So,
yeah, but I mean, like a backup quarterback behind like a really good quarterback.
So you're talking
who's,
like, about
like
a Tanner McKee. Well, Tanner McKee was a starter at Stanford, but like what Tanner McKee is for the Eagles now. But in college.
No, I'm saying like you go to school one and you ball out for a year and you're still got your ego, You still got all those people in your ear from high school. You play one good year and then someone goes, come here, stupid. You can go and back up someone who's way better than you, way more. Look, hey, buddy, you ain't running a 4-4 nothing, okay? Ever. You like, it's never going to happen, all right? Like, essentially, just be a really, like a poorer man's Ty Simpson, okay? Like, I'm just talking about that kind of guy. I know Tyson's in the first round.
QB. Let's
hey, some respect on that. Hey, we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. So, and then you go and you just back up somebody who's like a Heisman candidate for 2 or 3 years. And then you back up the 5-star they get after that. I'm just saying, this sounds like a good life.
Here's the thing, Godfrey. And this is, look, it's a violent game. The quarterback runs more than they ever have in the natural course of things. If you're that person for multiple years, you're probably starting games.
You will have don't go to Georgia Tech. Don't go to Georgia Tech. They're going to make you piss blood. Don't do that, okay? Like, Georgia Tech, don't do that. Haynes King has a death wish.
We brought up Aaron Filo. Aaron Filo is now one in the situation where he is competing for a starting job at Florida because he followed Buster Faulkner, the offensive coordinator, from Georgia Tech to Florida. And he got there. The assumption was he was going to just get the job. But they've got a guy named Tremel Jones Jr. who had taken all the offseason snaps when DJ Lagway was hurt last year. Players love him. And Tremel Jones Jr. has made the most of every opportunity he's gotten. So that one's going to probably come down to both of them playing in the first two games. And you figure out by the Auburn game who your guy is. But either one, I think you'd feel comfortable with. So the season doesn't fall apart if one of them gets hurt.
I am going to watch Florida this year with a little bit of curiosity early on and be like, okay, who had the death wish? Was it Faulkner, King, or their O-line ass head coach? Who was deciding to run directly into the wood chipper?
I can tell the answer to that one right now.
Okay, who was it?
His name rhymes with Spent C.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I thought. Basically, it's a right guard mentality to life.
Remember,
and I'm
Buster
not talking
Faulkner
about the deodorant.
Comes from the pure uncut air raid Chris Hatcher tree.
Yeah, no, I interviewed him when he was at Middle Tennessee State on how would you scheme. It was the year after Jadeveon decapitated Denard. And Vincent I was Smith. Asking, oh, that's, I'm sorry. Sorry, my apologies to Denard. Whatever. All you know, Michigan players, they're all the same. I interviewed Buster about like, how do you account for Jadeveon when you have an inferior talent either on the line or the skill position, whatever. And he was not that guy. He was not like, I'm going to take my quarterback and I'm going to jam him into the hole 17 times in a row. So maybe you're right, Andy. Maybe that's a Brent Key philosophy to life.
No, it's also this is what Haynes King can do philosophy. This is what he's best at.
I think it was also Haynes King who was like absolute. That, yeah. I think he embraced content. I bet he's a middle child.
Oh, no,
child.
Yeah. Haynes King's
I bet
a
he's a middle child.
Like,
yeah. Is Haynes King a middle child? As someone who has an odd number of children.
Yeah.
So I have three children. So, is Haynes King a middle child?
I'll tell the on three talent evaluation guys. Like, we need to know where everybody stands in the sibling order.
Dude. You need middle males for particularly sort of violence inclined positions, for sure. You don't need that eldest hesitation and thoughtfulness. You need someone who tried to jump off a roof barefoot.
How do you explain Tim Tebow, who was the youngest?
Dude, how
does
he was
Mr.
Really
Dan the Torpedoes too.
I know. How does anyone? Because he was built like a baby rhinoceros.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I did play pickup with the middle brother Peter, and he was pretty tough. He'd throw some elbows.
Really?
So back to the backup quarterbacks, like how many would have entered the spring portal? I think. How many quarterbacks?
This is a great question, Ross, because I think.
Yeah, like 10, 30, 50.
So your Alabama competition would have had to have a winner by the end of the spring because Austin Mack or Keelan Russell would have probably been out. Your
Florida, maybe?
Your Florida competition. Your Tennessee competition between Faison Brandon and George McNair. Maybe that's not that one, though, because that's a redshirt freshman and a true freshman coming out of high school.
What I was on that one, they were going to hold on.
The Virginia competition between Bo Perbula and Eli Holstein. I think one of them goes probably if you make a decision. Missouri is an interesting one because they announced Austin Simmons as a starter very early. And I think if you were worried about losing Matt Zollers, you don't do that.
Mm. Yeah. But it changes everything, right? I mean, not having that portal changes everything. And, you know, you do wonder, too, if we still might have that portal. I'm still not convinced that nobody's going to move.
I said this because we kicked this around transfer. Amongst us at the On3 staff as the Sorsby stuff was going down. And we kind of came to the agreement that if Will Hammond's not on Texas Tech's roster, if they had an unproven guy or just a person that they'd brought in for depth, kind of a camp arm type situation, they would be the candidate to try the ghost transfer thing. But
yeah,
because they have Will Hammond, I don't think they would do that. Like, for instance, if Darian Mensah were to take a wrong step, you know, walking across the street and tear his ACL right now, I would not be shocked if Miami tried something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ghost transfer.
Feels like it needs a theme song. The ghost transfer thing really comes down to, is it worth your time and trouble and money hiring attorneys? Because you're going to win. The player's got to be worth the trouble. And so far, I don't see a situation where you need somebody where there's a player out there that's good enough.
Speaking of lawyers, right, Mr. Sorsby has retained Jeffrey Kessler, and Mr. Kessler is trying to get the NCAA to resolve or reinstate him with some eligibility for this season, or he will file a lawsuit and or Sorsby will just go to the NFL.
I'll be interested to see what Kessler does. The other member of the All-Star legal team that has been retained by Mr. Sorsby is Scott Thompson, who represented Bill Self in the NCAA case that was touched off by the FBI investigation. So lots of legal firepower on Brendan Sorsby's side, whether that matters or not. Because
whatever came of that FBI investigation? Oh, nothing. That's right.
Yeah.
Not there a damn thing.
Now, I'm very curious. Jeffrey Kessler has a pretty sterling record suing sports leagues.
Yeah,
I'd be very
curious.
He
doesn't lose often.
I think even if you found the friendliest local judge in Lubbock, Texas, I don't know that they're going to have an argument against a rule against betting on your own team. That's a pretty hard bar to clear. So, but who knows? Anything can happen, and it's college football, so anything probably will happen. We'll talk to you on Thursday.